Obviously, you formed a band, but at that time, what kind of music were you into?
Just anything. Like, we didn't have older brothers or sisters. No one in the group did, so we were quite... we didn't really have a roadmap or any guidance, and everyone at school was just... I don't know, they were into, like, The Doors or Bob Dylan or loads of people who were already dead or whatever. And so we just started with chart music and would go and see a band, and then we'd go and see their support band and their support band. And, you know, within about a couple of months, you're going to see Sudden Death Cult downstairs at the Clarendon in some toilet with 40 other people, I don't know. But we were sort of having to sort of search out that scene at the time, and actually retrospectively. I mean, I can remember getting... like White Riot by The Clash, which had already been out for years, and just thinking, well, I really have to listen to this because I have to like it because they're a really important band. And I think the first time I played it, I actually just couldn't hear a tune in it at all. It took me about 40 listens till I actually started to find something that I could grab onto. And so we all actually reworked at music. You know, we thought, well, these are the things we need to find out about, and then, you know, we worked really hard to like them. So it's interesting now, I just, you know, my daughter's 14, and I suppose things are so instant now that you can just go on YouTube or Spotify. If you don't like something, like 5 seconds later, you just move on. But we couldn't really do that. You know, once you'd invested the money in a record, you just have to listen to it.
you just have to like it, really.
And it was important to like write things, and you know, so that when you went to gigs and people, I don't know, slagged off a band and said, well, they're just copying, you know, Captain Beefheart, and you think, who the fuck is that? You know, I've got no idea. I have to rush to, like, the record library and get these records out and work at it.
Do you remember the first gig you went to?
The first gig I went to was the Teardrop Explodes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Reward was their big hit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was at the Hammersmith Palais. It was a big gig. I mean, they were in the charts and everything,
Wow.
It was great.
And when, what inspired you to make music?
well, I think after, you know, we were going to all these gigs, and then, I mean, we were going like 3-4 nights a week, and gigs back then were, I mean, it's interesting that now the gigs are the really expensive things and all the records are free. Back then, you know, you could go and see a band for £1, you know, and so it was really cheap. We didn't drink, we were only children, so it was a really cheap night out. And you get to know people in the scene, and, you know, it was the mid-80s, unemployment was incredibly high, and loads of people didn't have jobs. Most people were on the dole, especially in that scene. And everyone was in a bloody band. I mean, everyone. Possibly three bands. And most of them were, I mean, appalling, they really were. But it was fun, you know, anyone could get up and play. And, you know, people have said to me, like, oh, you know, what were you inspired by? When, you know, were you inspired by the Cocteau Twins or Susie and the Banshees? Did you think that's what I want to do? And I said, no, God, I thought those bands were really intimidating. I thought, well, I can never get as good as that. But when you see, like, I don't know, the Bazookas, you know, downstairs at the Marquee or something, and they're just banging a load of shit together, you think, well, I could do that, actually. So, I could never go at that.
You did put together a fanzine, didn't you, with Emma?
Yes. Yes.
How did that come about? And how, there were about 5 issues, weren't there, do you remember?
Yeah, we got up to issue E. I don't think we ever put out issue E, actually.
It's called Alphabet Soup.
Alphabet Soup is like ABCDE, you know. It was really juvenile and smutty, and it was just full of swear words, and actually Viz Comic used to contribute to it. They thought it was hilarious. Yeah. They used to send us a page to put in it because they just thought it was very funny. But it was just things like top 10 charts with all the band's names changed with swear words and, you know, things like that. It was ridiculous.
Did you do reviews on the web?
I think we started to, which is why I think we stopped it, actually, because it actually started to get a bit too serious and make kind of sense. You know, it was all kind of teenage quizzes, you know, are you a goth, you know, answer the questions A, B, C, D, E, you know, it was just very silly. And we kind of did it as well because we were very, very shy, and we'd go to these gigs and we were like 15 and we didn't know anyone. And actually, it was impossible to go up and talk to people, we just didn't have the confidence. So I thought, well, if we do a fanzine, well, you've got an excuse.
Exactly. Yes.
And then we sort of flog that, and then we did get in the scene. Yes, it was good fun.
So when you were doing the fanzine, at that time, although you were very much into music, but were you into making music at that time, or did that come just after?
No, that came after. I mean, I did get a guitar, but I was just, you know, I didn't do music at school, neither did Emma. We were completely self-taught. The first band I played in was a band called The Bugs, and I was at a gig. I used to go and see them. They were just a kind of garage band. And then their bass player was leaving and going to America, so I was very drunk at this gig. And I said, oh, I'll play bass for you. Never played bass in my life. So I had a week to kind of learn how to play the bass and play their songs. Luckily, their songs were quite easy, so it was fine. The guitar took a little bit longer. And so everything was a bit kind of, oh, you know, you just agree to things and then you do them. A bit like this, actually.
Okay. You did form a band with Emma called the Baby Machines.
That, well, that was just the first name.
Yes.
It was Lush.
It was, of course. But yeah, that was the beginning of what became Lush, wasn't it? Really?
Yeah. So Emma was in a band called the Rover Girls. I was in the Bugs. We were both playing bass. And we just thought, well, it would be quite fun to do our own band. So we'd sit there in Emma's kitchen, like, with a sort of, I think we had a drum machine, actually. But, it, you know, it's just terrible. We'd just sit there kind of clanging away. Mm. But eventually it kind of developed into something. I mean, I think when it really took off is when I met Chris, who was the drummer, at North London Poly. So when I started doing English there, I met him, and he was actually a really good drummer, and he'd been in loads of punk bands, and I was like, I remember the first time I met him, I just got talking to him because he had a Southern Death Cult t-shirt on, and I was like, ah, kindred spirit, and then I just said, like, oh, you know, do you want to play in our band? And he went, yeah, all right, and then we thought, right, now we need to get good, because he's actually good, and so, yeah.
Do you remember when you played live for the first time or something? You know, what was the early live music experience with the band like?
Oh, it was terrible. We were awful. Absolutely unlistenable. We had a different singer. We had Meriel. Actually, Meriel had a really nice voice, but we were all over the place, and it was a total mess. But it was fun, you know. It was, I don't know, at the Falcon, probably, in Kentish Town, and lots of people would, you know, you'd get these bands, but it was, you know, it was noisy and you couldn't really make out half the sound, and it was all about going and having a night out, really. So, but I think, you know, we played for a while and we played all these pub gigs, and then I think Meriel, I said, it wasn't really her thing. Plus, she got this boyfriend, you can never get her out of the bloody flat. So I just, we actually thought, well, we just need to kind of step it up a bit. And we advertised to try and find another singer. So we put an ad in the Melody Maker. It's a complete disaster. So everyone who turned up was like basically either a psychopath or, you know, or just weird, you know. It was a really nice girl, but she was like a cabaret singer, I remember. So every song was like, you know, like really over the top. There was some other woman who was claustrophobic, so she said we'd have to get her taxis everywhere. There was another one who seemed really sweet. We were in the pub with her, and then she was just an utter racist. It was awful, actually. Oh, yeah. we just couldn't find anyone. So in the end, because I'd been doing backing vocals, Emma said, well, you're just going to have to sing. And I was like, oh, for Christ, you know. And I was desperately asking everyone to get anyone to join, because we were awful anyway, so no one wanted to. So again, just by default, I became a singer.
Was it, before doing the auditions and stuff, was it in your mind that it might have to come to you to be...
No, absolutely
it
not.
It didn't cross your mind at all?
Not at all. I thought, bound to find someone.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, there's loads of people, they all want to be in bands. You know, it's a bit of a laugh or whatever, but I didn't think it would be that difficult, actually. Because all the people we'd ever got in the band, I mean, Meryl, first bass player Steve, they're just mates, you know. I mean, Steve couldn't play the bass. Still fucking can't, but... you know, you just go, it would be like asking someone to go to a pub or something. You'd go up and go like, you know, do you want to join a band? Like, yeah, all right, you know. And that was it, really.
Do you think in those days, maybe before, but in the 80s and maybe early 90s, that it was easier to get people to join things like bands as opposed to nowadays, there's lots more of them and it's just kind of more of a big thing that people might be wary of? Because from what you're saying, it was quite easy to get people on board.
Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah, I suppose people had more time because, you know, lots of people didn't have jobs. Mm. It was quite a community, even being on the dole, you know, it wasn't that isolating. Bloody loads of people out there, you know what I mean, and just hanging out. And I think, you know, students as well. I think, I don't know if it's different. I mean, they've got the internet now, so I imagine that if you're looking for someone, it's probably... much easier in that way, you know, you can hook up with all sorts of people, I imagine, but, you know.
When did the band become Lush?
Probably, I don't think we ever played as the Baby Machines, it was just, it was right from the start.
It was about 87, I think, and then not that long after, I gather.
I think it was 89, actually.
Oh, okay. But it was around that period that you actually signed.
Oh, no, no, you're right.
Yeah.
I think 89 was the first record.
Yeah, that was 4AD.
Yeah. So I think we were just gigging.
So what led to... Because you became the lead singer, and then you signed to 4AD. How did that come about?
Well, we had a demo tape, and we sent it out. Well, the thing is, we'd already got reviewed in the press.
Do you remember would an early review spring to mind?
Well, the first review we got was in the Melody Maker, and it was Chris Roberts wrote it. And, you know, they were so superlative in those days, the journalists. It was all about, I don't know, creating a scene, or it was a bit tabloid, actually. So he wrote this bloody review, which was lovely. It was great to sort of see yourself there, and all great big review. But he said that we'd be, like, bigger than the Middle East or something, you know. So it just, like, he put the pressure on, and we just about had, like, 6 songs, and we could just about play 20 minutes. And then, of course, all these people turned up going, like, right, this is going to be, like, the next Sundays or something. And this sort of shambolic kind of noise emanates from the stage. And we'd be like, fucking hell, this is terrible. So then we had to kind of... really catch up with ourselves and try and really, you know, get it together and get better as musicians and tighter and all of that. But it was tricky. But I think because of that, we did get that sort of attention. And so Rough Trade, 4AD, you know, various independent labels were, you know, happy to come along and see us. I mean, we were going to sign to Rough Trade, actually. Jeff was quite interested. But then when Ivo, who ran 4AD, when he was, he decided that he quite liked it. He was a bit unsure because it was quite a mess. So he actually put us in a studio with John Fryer, a producer, to demo, really. He just said, if you can demo some songs, I can see a potential, but it's just, you know, it's quite hard to dig it out at the moment. So... we demoed the 3 songs and he really liked them. And then he said, well, why don't you demo another 3? And so we did that. And then that was Scar, which was like a mini album. And he just put it out as it was, you know. Couldn't fucking believe it, you know. And when he was like, yeah, I'm going to sign you, I was like, this is a joke. But yeah, no, it's great.
And how did it feel when you got the initial popularity and stuff? Obviously, it was great to get signed and have stuff released. But was there a point that you felt... we're actually in a band and we kind of made it even, you know what I mean? And, you know, and you can, after being signed, you obviously continue to do gigs and all that sort of thing, but...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we ever felt like this that kind of, oh, we've made it. I mean, we were never really a band with that kind of game plan. And I used to read interviews with whoever, you know, Oasis, whatever, you know, they'd be going like, yeah, we're going to be headlining the O2 Centre or wherever, we're going to be headlining Wembley Stadium this time next year. Maybe that's why they got there, actually. We just didn't think like that.
I think with them, it's definite arrogance and ambition.
Yeah, but I mean, there's nothing wrong with a bit of self-confidence and swagger, but I just think that we just didn't have it. To me, it was like, great, we're going to...
One step at a time, really.
Yeah, but I really enjoyed every step of it. To be honest, it was actually more fun and more exciting travelling around in the back of a van, you know, playing little gigs, than it was eventually, you know, going around America in with all the fancy gear and everything. You know, it's exciting on the way up.
Yeah, yeah. When did you do the John Peel session? What was that like, if you can remember?
I can't remember when it was. It was probably after Spooky, I don't know, I'm not sure. He was a bit ambivalent about us, actually. I think he thought we were possibly... I don't know if he liked that 4AD thing. It was a bit serious for him, I think. But because we did this ABBA cover...
What was that?
Oh, we did a song called Hey Hey Helen.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yes, oh yes, it's one of their really obscure ones. And then he suddenly warmed to us. I remember he was actually playing a record on the radio. And he went, oh, we should have done an ABBA cover. And then suddenly it was like...
Quirky, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so he liked that, so he gave us a session. And it was fine. It was at that Maida Vale. Loads of people I know used to complain about Peel sessions because you get someone there who mixes it and they've got their own engineers and it can be a bit, you know, you haven't got control in that. But I thought they were very nice, actually. There was one woman who was a bit of a cow, but apart from that, you know.
Do you remember playing Glastonbury? I'm sure you do.
Yes.
Do you know when that was?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
When was it?
I don't know.
I actually slightly lost my mind.
92.
Was it 92?
I'm sure someone would have known that.
Yeah, I had quite a bad time. Actually, I went missing, yeah.
What? Actually, you went missing at Glastonbury?
Yeah, it was the fucking Happy Monday bowl. And our manager at the time, who was a complete fucking nutcase, bought all this ecstasy off them. And was just fucking handing it around like Smarties. And it was kind of, I think there was like bloody heroin in it or some, God knows what was in it, because I just went completely off the bloody wall.
Was this before the gig, do you know?
No, it was after, thank God.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, it was that kind of like, well, yeah, we've played, great, now we can hang out. And I remember the guy I was going out with at the time, poor thing, just completely. I mean, we were just a complete mess, and they were looking for me, they couldn't find me, they had the police. I ended up in a police station because I thought I'd been attacked. I just didn't know what the bloody hell was going on.
Oh my God.
And they let me, I didn't have my shoes or anything, so they took me back to the site on the Sunday after keeping me in the station, and then they, because I was going, oh, I've got to find my shoes, you know. I was like wandering around, like thinking, Christ knows what. And I ended up hitching back. And there were these two guys and they were in a car and they said, oh, you all right? And I was like, I think I'd actually even, I was walking along the road and I thought, do you know what, I'm going to lie down now and I'm just going to die and then it will all be over and I can move on. And then this car, literally at that moment, these two blokes said, like, oh, are you going back to London? And I was like, yeah. And they said, well, do you want a lift? And I thought, oh, this is all some plan. I see what's happening here. Someone's controlling this. And I got in this car, and about 20 minutes later, one of them turned around and said, like, would you sign my shirt? And I was like, you're fucking joking. And I just sat there, like, frozen. They let me out at Hammersmith, and I phoned Emma, and I think, yeah, I did. I sort of thought, okay, this is now this is where I die. And then I phoned Emma just before I thought I have to die. And she said, where are you? fucking hell. Like, so, yeah.
I didn't expect that when I asked the question.
Yes, I haven't thought about that for a long time, actually. Wow. Yeah, it was quite alarming.
Have you not mentioned, discussed that in interviews the last few years?
No, I don't know. I don't think I have, actually. Funnily enough, buried my memory.
Anyone there at the gig here tonight? Maybe not. Did you, you know, like, having signed a 4OD, very big indie label, obviously you did the John Peel session, Glastonbury, did it feel like so much was happening at once, or, you know what I mean? Because you didn't ask for any of this in a way, did you?
You mean in terms of, like, attention? Or,
well, I guess
or
so,
just
everything
the...
really, like, just how the attention you were getting and everything, really, you know, so much was going on, really.
I think because it's, you know, you're just working all the time. I mean, it's great because it's music and that's what you want to do, but it's quite a treadmill, actually. It's sort of, you know, writing and then you go and you promote it and then you tour, and then as soon as you're back from tour, it's like, right, do the next one. And so I didn't really, you know, we go to gigs and you get to, you know, people going, oh, look, it's me, or whatever, but it wasn't like, you know, we don't really make that much money as well, which probably makes, you know, we were on an independent label. We didn't get £1 million deals. We didn't, you know, gigs at that time, you didn't get the kind of money you get now. You know, you actually, the record companies to fund you to go on tour because you always lost money. So it was, you know, it's kind of a different world. So no, I didn't feel like, hey, time to light the cigars and get a limo everywhere or something. No, it wasn't really like that. It was, I mean, it was good fun, but, you know.
I think I read an interview the last couple of days or so, and you were saying, kind of hinting at, there was a different persona, like Mickey from Lush wasn't or isn't really the real you. What's the difference? There is a difference, though, or was.
I think everybody has that who performs. I mean, nobody is. I mean, actually, I do remember doing an interview once, and, you know, Emma was sort of talking about how frustrating it is that, you know, you talk in these interviews and then they write about you, and then it's not you. It's like they're writing about someone else, and they never really get who the real you is. And I think it was one of the Stud brothers who said, like, well, isn't that a good thing? I can't imagine anything more terrifying than actually someone, you know, genuinely representing me on the printed page there for everyone to see. And I did think, yeah, there's probably something in that, you know. But I think anyone who's in a band is, you're never really seeing the real them. I mean,
no.
But I don't know what the difference is. I think Mickey from Lush is maybe a bit more of an arsehole, but I don't know.
That's it, yeah, you just said something like that in an interview that I read recently, you know. But I suppose that's right, if you're on stage, you're projecting either a different part of you or someone else who isn't necessarily the real person. Did you have a favourite part of being in the band, like whether recording or playing live?
I think playing live was, for me, always the best, because it's really immediate, and, you know, if you play and, you know, there's a crowd there, there's a lot of energy, you know. I think making a record is great, and there is something incredibly satisfying about writing a song and thinking, wow, you know, I've just created this out of nothing, and then other people get involved and people are playing on it and produced it, and so that's really exciting. But I think the immediacy of playing live is pretty irreplaceable, I think, so...
And is it the reaction from the, like, audience, and also with the band on stage as well, the whole experience of that?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think anyone who, you know, performs in public, I mean, even someone who's a sports person, you know, they'll say that kind of feeling off the crowd, and there's a sort of combined energy that's actually, you know, it's great to make an event, you know. It's exciting. I like going to gigs. I like playing them, you know. It's a lot of excitement to be had.
Would you have a highlight of albums that you did? Love Life was a big one, but that came towards the end, really. But, you know, this certainly wasn't your first. Was there a particular, like, album that you enjoyed making or writing that you found more satisfying, maybe, than others?
I think they were all a bit traumatic, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we... I mean, there's sort of really big highs and lows, you know. I think, like I say, that idea of actually writing something and seeing it come to fruition and become a piece of music is very, very, you know, I don't know, it's very fulfilling. But equally, you know, it can be quite frustrating when it comes out not how you want it. And it's difficult working with people creatively. It can really spark, but actually it often jars as well, and you can get quite emotional about someone going, no, I don't think that works. You go, no, it does work, and fuck you, you know what I mean? And people are sort of arguing, and I don't know, it's sort of, I suppose, because it matters a lot. But I think that's probably true of all kind of creative.
Yeah, I was about to say, though, that creative people are never that happy with whoever they are, Michael Jackson or George Lucas, with what they put out. They're just never satisfied enough, are they, really?
Yeah, and I don't think you can be entirely. There's always going to be something that you feel, oh, should have changed that, or I don't like that bit, you know. So I don't really listen to our stuff. I used to just record it, all right, and I'd have to hear that again, you know, and we'll just play it live. But
I mentioned Love Life. That was quite a different sound to some of your early recordings, really, wasn't it? More poppy, would you agree?
Well, I think the actual production of it was really different. So I think when we started, actually Scar was really raw, but then we worked with Robin Guthrie, who was in the Cocteau Twins, and he had a very Cocteau Twin sound. You know, it's lots and lots of guitar effects and stuff on the vocals. And then when we did Split, it was a bit more stripped back, but there's still, you know, we were still slightly growing in confidence. So I think by the time we got to Love Life, we played so much live that we actually were, you know, pretty competent by then. So we recorded it with our sound man, and the sound was much more, it was much less produced, basically. I never really thought that the music itself was particularly different, but it probably did have a kind of clearer, more obvious sound, vocals up front, you know, all that kind of stuff.
When Lush were no more, did you make a deliberate decision to no longer be involved with music?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, the band ended with Chris the drummer committing suicide, and basically it was a massive shock. He wasn't, you know, the sort of person who you ever would have imagined had done that. And I think for me it was just, you know, that's it, party over, you know. I didn't want to do I just didn't want to be reminded of it. And, you know, I think when you lose someone who's really close to you, it makes you I don't know, I think I always felt like I was there for a lot of people. You know, you have to socialise, and you're out there, and you're with other bands and all of that stuff, and actually suddenly none of that stuff mattered anymore. So I just wanted to do, I just wanted to get out, actually. So I did.
What did you do? I don't want, like, a history of the last 20 years, but was there something that you particularly made a point of doing aside from music? Pursuing another interest?
Not really. I just, you know, I mean, I spent a year on my arse, you know, sort of not really doing anything, and then just had to get a job. So, you know, and I started working in publishing. And again, you know, I had a mate who was going, oh, you know, you should try and write for the NME, or you should try and work at music papers. And I thought, no, I don't want to. I don't want to go into that. So, no, I just left it, and, you know, had kids, blah, 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 you know, so.
Did you ever look back and in a nostalgic way, you know, because it was a big part of your life for a long time, really, and, you know, you certainly had success. Or are you, or were you, at any point, one to reminisce and look back and, you know, perhaps mix memories?
I didn't really used to think about, well, it was like it's like another life, you know, it was like something that happened to someone else. So, you know, I don't. It's only recently everyone at work found out that I was in a band.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it because of getting back together in a way?
Yeah, because I had to sort of keep vanishing off with things. And, oh, sorry about this, but yeah, I don't really. I just feel a bit of an arsehole, don't you? Going, oh yeah, I used to be in a band, and you know.
So I have to ask, what did lead to the band getting back together, and whose actual idea was it?
Well, we did look at it a few years ago, because Phil, the bass player, has been playing with the producer Mary Jane. And obviously, you know, they got back together. I mean, they were a lot bigger than us, but I think, you know, he was sort of saying it would be a good idea. And I was like, it's going to be really difficult to make this work, because at the time, my kids were still really small. I didn't really want to do it, actually, but I think this time it was a bit different, because I think, well, you know, I'm going to be 49 this year, and I thought, fuck, if I don't do this now, then that's it, you know, really, with that door closed. And I think Emma really wanted to do it, and, you know, Phil as well, and I thought, oh, maybe I should just drop the kind of, well, as Phil puts it, the kind of Greta Garbo of indie, you know, sort of, I should drop the sort of, oh, I'm not doing it thing, so I agreed. Slightly worried about having done that now, but never
mind. Once it was all decided, what was the next step to actually, you know, what did you think, okay, we're back, we're going to do some gigs, we're going to do some recordings?
Well, again, it was quite nebulous, because what happened is Emma had actually written some songs, so I thought, all right, well, I'll write some lyrics, and then we got, she's friends with Daniel, who is in Ladytron, and so it wasn't the way we used to write songs, but she said, look, I'm going to work with him a bit on this, and I'll see what happens, and then he had Jim Abbas, who's a producer, who had worked with him on one of a Ladytron album, and then we all met up, and he said, well, we've wanted to do something together again for ages, and this might be the thing to do. So it was quite organic, actually. It just grew out of there, you know. So that was really the first thing we did, and then the idea of playing some gigs kind of came together, and there was not a great grand plan. It was just a bit piecemeal.
As before, in a way, really.
Yeah.
So the Roundhouse were the first gigs announced, is it two you're doing, and sold out now, aren't they?
I think the second one there still might be some tickets.
So check out the website. Did you feel initially like really daunted, and did you question it after? Oh God, what are we doing?
I do that every day.
Which is not a bad thing, but then you probably reassure yourself that it is the right thing to be doing, maybe.
I think the actual, you know, we've been rehearsing with Justin from, who used to be in Elastica, he's playing the drums. So, he lives in Worthing, yeah.
Yeah,
you've probably seen him around, yeah.
Not knowing it.
So actually just playing music, being in a rehearsal room, actually playing is great. Mm. And it's really nice, actually. I'd forgotten how much fun it was to just spend the whole day playing. Mm. And actually, the recording was really good fun as well. It's just all the other fucking shit I can't deal with. So.
Do you think you're better this time? Are you feeling more optimistic?
Well, it will be better because it's more limited, you know. And so I think before it was such a treadmill, and you felt that you had to do, you know, you're at the beck and call of, I mean, not so much 4AD, you were great, but, you know, there is a record company. There's a lot of other people relying on you to keep going. And actually, it just can just become relentless. I mean, the touring was unbelievable by the end. It was just stupid. And whereas now it's like, you know, I've still got a full-time job and I've got the kids. And, you know, it's like there's a limited amount that I can actually do. So,
yeah. Well, they must be very accommodating.
My kids?
No, you employ.
Oh, my job. Oh, yes, they're lovely. You know, they're quite excited.
How did you feel about the reaction to Lush reforming and the gigs and every? You know what I mean? It's been like. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, it was quite surprising, actually. I suppose it's different now because you've got all that social media, so it's quite instant, isn't it? I mean, it's great. I wasn't really expecting that, actually. No. So, yeah, it's quite nice, isn't
really
it?
A big, nice surprise.
Yeah.
There are some people who are going to be seeing the band play live soon, aren't they? Like, Richard, you're going, aren't you?
Yeah.
Young lady in the back who made you the cake. I don't know her name. There she is, hand up, but standing over the back there, yes. So you're playing America first, aren't you? When is that?
April.
April.
Yeah, we're playing at that Coachella festival.
Oh, yes,
thing.
So you are, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Wow, God. Exciting stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
What can you just tell us about the EP?
How does
that sound?
It sounds like Lush.
so it should.
Yeah, we haven't gone all funk or something.
Would you say that the sound has kind of developed or changed that much, or it's like what people might expect?
I don't know what people are expecting.
I suppose if you're so involved with something, whatever it is, it's hard to be that objective, because you can't, you know, like, people look at it from the outside, that's fine, but you're so involved with it. You ask questions like, well, how's the sound change, blah, blah, but maybe you don't know that, you know what I mean?
I mean, I suppose because it was written in a very different way, because Daniel was involved, and I think that meant, you know, usually we'd have all the guitars and, you know, all of this stuff would be going on, so it's a bit stripped back from that, but apart from that, you know, I just think it sounds like Lush, really. You know, the trickiest part was writing lyrics for me. You know, Emma wrote the songs, and I think she has always kept her hand in a bit, so it wasn't too bad. You know, it was more of a continuation for her. For me, it was going back after 20 years, you know, and I thought, fuck, what do you write about? You know what I mean? It's, and I must have rewritten some of those lyrics like 3 or 4 times, you know. Sometimes you write something, and 2 days later, I look at it, oh, I can't sing this. This is awful.
When's the EP out?
I should know that, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
I think they're putting it out for... I think the main track will be out next week, actually,
oh, really?
For streaming and
this
iTunes.
This is a world exclusive. You probably knew that already, didn't you?
Yeah, Richard probably knows all the information. I'm hopeless with all that. I think the actual product itself is coming out not till April, but I think, I don't know, you know, Steve Lamacq's playing it or something, isn't he? And, you know, that's the big...
Yeah.
So, yeah, iTunes next week, I think.
And have you got any promotion lined up, like radio or whatever?
I think we will do something, but I don't know what. Sorry.
No, I'm sure. That's
plugs. Yes.
I think that's about it with me, but see if there's any questions from the audience, shall we? Now, are there any questions... at all. Now, especially if you're at the back, if you can like project your voice so the room can hear you, that'd be cool.
Can you still get some of that ecstasy?
We have to ask Andy Mondays about that.
Sensible questions, please. You've got one at the back, haven't you?
So, like most Americans, I'm kind of guilty of lip swiping when Love Life came out. But the upside has been there is now a trove music I never even really listened all that much to before, and I absolutely love the album. I really did listen to it a bunch of times. But what I was kind of curious about is, throughout that record, there are a bunch of characters that are kind of created with each song. There's a lady killer, there's a child catcher, there's an Olympia, I guess. My question was, has anyone ever approached about doing a musical based on Brooklyn?
No, but if you want to write it, I will happily endorse it.
Well, we'll give Andrew Lloyd Webber a call. Wow.
I recently found out on an interview that the lyrics of Larry Keeler, whom I've been listening to for years and years, were, and you always picture, who the hell is that guy in tandem with a girlfriend? And then I recently read somewhere, I don't know if it's true or not, that you based it on the singer of Chili Peppers. is that an anecdote that you would like to talk about, or is not really about, I mean...
Well, it's actually three different people in that lyric, and I always feel a bit cruel, actually, because, oh, you know, it's... You write a song about someone, it's a bit unfair on them, really, because they don't have a comeback, and you're showing them in a certain light just to suit what you want to say. So I do feel a bit, you know, a bit crappy about it. I mean, yes, you know, we went on tour with the Chili Peppers and Anthony Kiedis. Yeah, I'm sure he's a lovely bloke, but he was just quite sex obsessed. He just talked about sex all the bloody time, and I just thought it was a bit weird, you know. And I thought, quite know what you're trying to do. Can we just talk about, and you know, I remember talking about shoes once and he turned that round to sex, and you talk about driving and he turned that round to sex, and I just thought it was quite odd, and it just, I don't know. And then there's two other people, but I'm not going to name them because I do feel a bit rotten, you know. Like I said, I'm sure Anthony's great when he's out with the guys, you know. He's not trying to, I don't know, sleazeball you or something, but...
Any more?
Unusually, Lush have re-recorded quite a few songs that they've already previously released, arguably with some varying degrees of success than others, like Thought Forms, Scarlet, Starless, the Child Catcher. What was the input, what was the reasoning behind you wanting to re-record them? And why was the Child Catcher left off Split? Because that's criminal.
Again, you know, because we were never that organised. I mean, I think some of them, I think Thought Forms and Scarlet, Robin just wanted to do them.
Was it true that you wanted to do Sweetness and Light again with Robin Guthrie, or was that just a rumour?
No, that was never going to happen. I think because Thought Forms and Scarlet were both on Scar, and Scar was really demos, you know. So, and because we made Spooky right afterwards, I think Robin really wanted to do them, you know. He actually... wanted to redo them. I think I can't even remember why we redid the other ones. It was probably because we just thought maybe we ran out of songs, I don't know.
Any more questions for Mickey?
I'm just so you guys have been apart and then back together, you've lived whole lives in that period in between, you've grown and become adults and parents and all that kind of stuff. Is there anything trepidatious about stepping out back in front of an audience again after all this time?
Yeah, it's a bloody nightmare. But so that's why we're just rehearsing our asses off, because I don't want to stand out there and think, fuck, I can't remember the chords, like... No, but it's difficult. I think I've done a couple of things, you know. I've played, I did a vocal appearance on something and I sang with the Mary Chain for something. And actually, I do think there's something about, it does come back to you, but doing your own gig is a bit weird and a bit daunting. But people keep saying, oh, you know, there's going to be a lot of love in the room and all of that, so I'm relying on that, you know.
This might be a bit of a personal question, but can you recommend me an album to listen to?
What, Lush?
No, not
Oh, anything?
Yeah, anything you listen to that you can recommend.
Anything that I've listened to? God, I'm so out of touch with anything that's current.
Old, new,
Have you ever listened to the Cocteau Twins?
I loved them.
Okay, so you know all about the Cocteau Twins. My tastes are a bit... I mean, I think Susie and the Banshees are a great band. I don't know if you know them.
Yes, I do.
I think Kiss in the Dream House was my favourite. Oh, God, you've really put me on the spot. I need to actually have my record collection in front of me. Have you heard of Weekend?
Who? Elaborate.
They're kind of... A Weekend around, it's that sort of early 80s, isn't it?
Oh,
I was thinking about that drum beat for Baby. It's quite jazzy,
okay.
But in a sort of indie way. And she's got a beautiful voice. I was actually listening to it quite recently and thinking, why isn't this album referenced more? It's so great.
Okay.
So yes, they go, brilliant, I came up with one, great.
<Thank you. clears throat>
Sorry, just one.
that you go back to right now for one?
Well, not Glastonbury, obviously. One gig.
Or recordings,
Well, I mean, actually, I can remember there was a great gig. I do remember playing in Hoboken in New Jersey, and it must have been like really early on, like one of our first times in America. And I just remember this sort of, again, because it was so unexpected, our first time in America, we thought, oh, is anyone going to come? Are they going to get it? And it was not a massive venue. It was probably maybe held like 600 or 700. But it was absolutely packed, and it was so boiling. I used to have my hair dyed red, and it just ran all down my face. And it just looked like I'd been struck with a hatchet or something.
Carrie.
But it was really, really exciting. And I just remember we all got in the van afterwards, and someone put the radio on. We had some slightly mad Vietnam vet driving us around, and he put the radio on, and it was that Without You, I Can Live. Like, not
Nielsen,
yeah, and just all of us in the van were just screaming our heads off singing this song. It was just such a great moment because we were so happy.
Any more questions so from me?
More in the same vein, do you ever find it hard to wind down then after a great gig and you've got a great audience response? What were the next 4 or 5 hours like? Trying to sleep or?
A lot of the time, especially in America, you know, you'd be getting straight on a tour bus and having to go to the next place. So, you know, invariably there'd be, you know, a fair amount of drinking, but, you know, you'd just go to sleep in a bunk, so you didn't have to get up in the morning, which was, you know, a good thing. But yeah, it's hard to wind down because you do just want to sort of like, oh, you know, it's all the adrenaline's going. Well, lots of gigs would have a club afterwards. I can remember like actually completely straining my neck because we were all headbanging at some metal club one night and just. yes, there was quite a lot of partying that went on, you know.
More to come.
Yeah, actually that doesn't work anymore. I really fit in, but at this age, you know.
By midnight with Bob Rawl or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
You never know, though. You could come out again, all that.
Yeah, it's the stamina that doesn't come out. That's the problem.
Time for one more question.
Last word to male, but the female were kind of up front with the guitar, with the vocals. I found that at the time unusual or atypical. In the sense that when they were all female band, then it was all girls, or there would be one girl, which would be the singer, and all boys behind, or there would be the girl playing the bass, and the rest boys. But you seem very, very balanced, two girls, two boys, and not the girls at the back, the girls up front, and the boys on the foreground. Did that feel? Unusual matching with the rest of the scene? Was it very male dominated? Was it hard to be?
Well, I think the point is that it was quite male dominated. So I think because there's fewer women, you know, people will go, they'll pick it out as something. So it will be like, oh, why are girls always the bass players? Or why are they always the singer? I mean, clearly, if there was 50% women in bands, then you wouldn't be having to say that because they'd just be in the many, many different places that they are or in different roles. I mean, there were a lot of other bands, you know, Babes in Toyland, all right, they were an all-girl band, but I think even, you know, I mean, I can remember going to see Rubella Ballet and they had, like, you know, two women and so there weren't always women in those roles. It's just that there weren't enough women. There probably still aren't, you know, I'm not that up on it. And I think you just need more, you know, it's like the more you get, the less of a point it is, you know, but I don't particularly think that women are, you know, attracted to a particular instrument or anything. It's just that it's not enough.
You recently featured on a documentary talking about being a woman in a band and how was to go to America where there was, especially Hollywood, very macho, you know, Jimmy Pepper, and Jane's Addiction and all these was it very difficult? Was it a little bit, do you find it a bit difficult to be in as a woman where the industry favoring
Yeah, I think the industry itself was quite sexist. I mean, the funny thing is when I was going to see bands, when I was downstairs at the Clarendon, when I was going to like gigs and stuff and selling fanzines, it wasn't really like that actually. There was loads of bloody women around and you weren't treated as anything different. You know, it was just, it's actually very accepting and fine. It was more when you were in a band suddenly and it was like, you know, the music industry, that was the thing that was actually more sexist, you know, and not, you know, not so bad that you feel like, you know, absolutely humbled and kind of pecked upon the whole time, but it was just irritating things, you know. Roadies who want to change a fucking guitar set up, oh, I'll set it up properly for you, love, you know what I mean? It's like, fucking leave it alone, you know. Just people assuming that you're, you know, I don't know. It gets tiresome when people go, oh, you were only on the cover because you're girls, you know, and I don't know, it's just tiresome, actually. But nothing that's going to crush you, really. It's just annoying to put up with.
And one last little thing.
Sorry, we've got to wrap it up.
Okay, no problem.
But thank you.
Yeah,
and thanks very much, Mickey.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a break for that for 20 minutes and then we'll be back with Kevin Jenkins. So do get a drink, have a wee, whatever you want to do.